I have said for over 10 years that the declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran.
I mean, I have John Bolton and I have other people that are a little more dovish than him. And ultimately, I make the decision.
This ratcheting up of tensions was all too predictable, all too calculated, and it has led us to the precipice of potential catastrophe.
The world must know that we do not go abroad in search of enemies.
As a candidate, Donald Trump promised to end America's current military engagements and avoid any new ones. But since moving into the White House, he has frequently and openly threatened war with Iran. In a tweet this past weekend, he warned, if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Close quote. In the Middle East, among U.S. allies in Europe and in the United States, that is not being dismissed as political bombast. One commentator has written, the sense of foreboding is tangible. The threats from both sides are no longer rhetorical. She is Robin Wright, who writes for The New Yorker magazine, longtime journalist and expert on that region. Welcome, as always, to our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What are the threats from both sides that you're talking about?
Well, the tension has been building since President Trump took office and abandoned the Iran nuclear deal and reimposed economic sanctions. But over the past 2 months, those tensions have escalated as the United States took the very unusual step of designating the entire Revolutionary Guards a terrorist organization. It's the first time the United States has done that about the conventional army of any country anywhere in the world. And for a few weeks after that, there was not a sense of major response or movement by Iran. But the United States claims that in early May, they began to see signs. They still haven't been specified, but they saw signs that the Iranians were deploying new equipment, including short-range missiles and personnel in a way that might threaten American interests, American allies, and American troops in the Middle East. And as a result, John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, announced the dispatch of the USS Abraham Lincoln and B-52 bombers to the Gulf and warned Iran that it would use unrelenting force if there was any kind of open provocation. And so since that moment, we've seen signs that both countries are now more confrontational. I don't think either country wants a war, but we've kind of crossed that threshold where with a larger deployment in the region, the U.S. has also sent in the USS Arizona and hundreds of Marines who are part of an expeditionary force, and the Iranians have in turn imposed a deadline on the European Union to help them offer relief on sanctions, or they will take steps to walk away from the nuclear deal, that we're now on a path that has benchmarks, that has of action that's required, that has a heavier U.S. deployment in the region. Those are the things that always make anyone worry that it could lead deliberately or accidentally into a much more dangerous confrontation.
Some of the players, of course, are very interesting in and of themselves. You mentioned John Bolton, National Security Advisor. Hasn't he, even though the U.S. may not want war now, hasn't he advocated in the past the bombing of Iran in order to try to change the regime there?
John Bolton is the largest hawk in the administration. He was for 8 years a spokesman for the Mujahideen Ilkhak, which is a Marxist Islamic cult, very unusual exile group, small opposition group, but has a lot of Western backers. And John Bolton is one of the main ones. He also wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in 2015 saying the only way to ensure Iran never got the bomb was to bomb Iran. He's called for regime change quite openly. So among the current decision makers, he's the most militant. But one of the interesting dynamics within the administration is you have the three key players on this issue taking different positions. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, had also earlier called for regime change when he was in Congress. He has since said, no, he just wants change of regime behavior. But he outlined 12 demands that were so sweeping that they would amount to effective regime change or certainly about face in policy and elimination of many of the key players. And then the third player, of course, is the one who is the ultimate decision maker, the decision maker in chief, Donald Trump. And he has repeatedly called for negotiations with Iran, said he would talk to the supreme leader. And when he was at the UN last fall, even went as far as to say that he thought the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, was probably a wonderful man. So while they all agree on what they don't want Iran to be doing, developing a bomb, missile tests, interventions across the Middle East, human rights abuses, missile tests, and so forth, they disagree when it comes to what happens next and, most importantly, how you get there.
When, on the one hand, President Trump talks, as you suggest, about negotiating, sitting down with President Rouhani or whatever it is he has in mind, how do you reconcile that with the statement that using the phrase the official end of Iran? I don't think that's a common phrase in diplomatic parlance.
No, it isn't. But then you remember that the president also talked about the North Korea and talked about fire and fury like it had never seen. So this is a president who uses those kinds of absolutes and extremes in describing what can happen if they don't deal with the United States. And of course, the Iranians responded in kind. The foreign minister tweeted back at Trump that he believed he wanted to point out that Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, and other aggressors failed to to take over Iran or to change its government, and that economic terrorism and, as he called them, genocidal taunts will not end Iran. So at this stage, we're in a rhetorical battle. I think both sides are looking for a way to de-escalate it at the moment. The Secretary of Defense has said today that the Iranians have taken unspecified moves to reduce the level of threats. But the question is, how do you get on an off-ramp? How do you formally de-escalate? Because they've now, whether it's deploying troops or given deadlines, there's still all these forces or factors in play that make one worry about what happens down the road, accidentally or purposefully.
Just give us some background on all of this. I think many of our listeners, of course, will remember the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran by Iranian militants in 1979. But the disputes between the United States and Iran go back way before that, do they not, all the way into the 50s?
Well, one of the interesting things is that America was, for many years, the savior of modern Iran. Harry Truman's ultimatum to Joseph Stalin to pull out his troops, which were occupying northern Iran, was the first crisis of the then new United Nations, and it was the United States that forced Stalin to do just that. And so the United States became the closest ally for Iran. But in 1953, as a democratically elected prime minister moved to nationalize oil, the United States and Britain were worried about the future of Iran and might have leaned, whether it was closer to the Soviet Union or take steps that were to the economic detriment of American and Western interests. And so the CIA and British intelligence orchestrated basically a kind of coup against the prime minister, public protest that forced him to resign and allowed the Shah to return from exile in Rome. And from that moment on, there have been deep suspicions among Iranians about what the United States wants. And does it always want someone who is an ally or even a lackey in power in Iran? And that, of course, has led to the takeover of the U.S. embassy when the U.S. took the Shah in 1979 for cancer treatment. There was suspicion that the U.S. was trying yet again to put the Shah back on the throne, that it was still standing with the monarchy. And those are tensions and suspicions that have unfortunately defined relations ever since.
We're talking with Robin Wright of The New Yorker magazine. Back with her in a moment. First, I want to introduce Negar Mortasavi. She is an Iranian-American journalist, a consulting editor to The Independent, based in Washington. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you about the history of all of this in Iran and the attitude toward the United States, which it seems to me to be very, very complicated.
It does. So the grievances on both sides, there's a long list of grievances on both sides. This is the animosity, as you mentioned, goes back to the 1950s, the CIA-backed coup where the Prime Minister Mossadegh was toppled, basically, and the monarch was reinstated and then supported by the U.S. for 2 decades. And then it moved into the revolution when the Iranian revolutionaries took over the U.S. embassy. And then it continues from there, all kinds of tensions and standoffs, from cyber attacks to actual military confrontation between proxies. And it's a long list. And each side, of course, has been playing its own grievances a lot more than considering the other side. The American public, of course, is more familiar with the U.S. side of the story. Part of the Iranian public is more familiar with the Iranian side of the story. And now it seems like we're at a new point of this tension and this standoff. And although the top leadership in both countries don't seem to want a war, and the population, the two societies, don't seem to want a war, but the way that the two sides are positioned in the region are very concerning and dangerous, and we might see an escalation and eventually a military conflict.
When the kinds of things that we've heard described over the past few weeks occur, to quote Robin Wright again, the sense of foreboding is tangible here. Is it tangible in Tehran as well? Are people worried about what's been going on?
People are very worried, I would say, a lot more than the American public, because for Americans, this is, even if a war starts, this is still going in a faraway land, and the impact it will have on the daily lives of the American people is not even comparable to the Iranians. Iranians still have a vivid memory of the 8-year war with Iraq in the 1980s, which devastated the country, devastated the economy, and it took years to recover from. And any kind of military conflict, this time with the world's superpower, the most powerful army, is just going to be devastating for Iranians. So I would say the Iranian society is even a lot more afraid and concerned about a war, and they follow the news and every update with more worry for what's to come. It's already affected the Iranian economy. It's already affected inflation with the sanctions and with internal corruption and mismanagement. Everything, the Iranian economy is already weak, and a military conflict of any form and any level in the region is just going to have a very severe effect on Iranian life.
Negar Mortasavi, once again with The Independent. Robin, right back to you. You have contacts with diplomats from Iran, particularly the foreign minister. What do you hear from them about what are described as incidents here, described by the Trump administration, incidents and threats of military action?
Foreign Minister Zarif was in New York at the United Nations last month, and I saw him 4 times, and sometimes in public meetings and sometimes one-on-one. And he made clear that the deepest fear inside Tehran is some kind of plot supported by some of Iran's Gulf adversaries that would lead to be used as a pretext to launch a war. And his message was that Iran wanted to avoid a war, and he even made an outreach gesture and called for some kind of negotiations that would lead to the release of all American prisoners held in Iran and Iranian people convicted in American courts. That, needless to say, is a non-starter, since we don't view Americans as prisoners in Iran. We view them as hostages or who have been unjustly imprisoned. But I think that the Iranians understand that they're at a tremendous military disadvantage, that the United States just as it did in Iraq and Afghanistan, far outmans and outguns anything Iran has. Now, that's not to say that the Iranians don't have their own forces, whether it's the proxies in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, who could challenge Americans and American allies across the Middle East. But I don't think the Iranians really want a war. I think they want what they would like very much is to contain America's presence in the region. And we've seen that in their attacks or their facilitation of attacks against American troops, whether it was in Iraq during the 8-year war there for many years in Afghanistan, providing the material for IEDs to be planted. And again, many Americans were killed by IEDs in both countries. But again, I don't think that they're looking for this big open confrontation, which they know they'd lose. And so I think there's been outreach on that. The problem is once you start putting deadlines on something and telling the rest of the world, the Europeans particularly, you have to help us with sanctions or we'll walk away from the nuclear deal, then you get into very dangerous territory. There is the prospect that if Iran does walk away from the nuclear deal sometime in the near future, that offers the pretext for military action. At the moment, that's not a justification because Iran continues to comply with the terms it signed in 2015 with the world's six major powers.
Once again, we're talking with Robin Wright of The New Yorker. So those six powers, including the nations in Europe, are very much involved with all of this, with the Iranians telling them to get sanctions lifted with the threat that Iran might walk away from the nuclear deal altogether. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. It's time to talk more about America's long-term allies and what's at stake for them in this confrontation between America and Iran. Stephen Erlanger is chief diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us from Brussels. Good to have you back on our To the Point show.
Thank you, Warren.
What is the position as far as the EU is concerned now? Are they being dragged in two directions by the United States and by Iran?
Well, they are. They're sort of trapped between Trump and Tehran. They support the Iran nuclear deal. They promise to hold to it. They say they'll hold to it so long as Iran holds to it. They say the only body that can judge whether Iran is keeping to its promises is the IAEA. And so far, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, has given Iran full marks with compliance. They're very annoyed with Donald Trump for pulling out of the agreement. They don't understand why Iran would negotiate with another American president. After all, they negotiated with the last American president and feel betrayed when this American president pulled out of the deal. So why would they trust him? But the Europeans also know that given the power of American dollar, the power of the American banking system, and the power of economic sanctions, they have a very weak hand to play. They can't really give the Iranians very much. They're kind of hoping that China, which is the largest buyer of Iranian exported oil, will continue to do that, and that Russia will continue to do that. Both of those countries are also signatories to the deal. While the Europeans are trying to set up this kind of strange barter program, which would mostly be used for non-sanctioned goods like drugs, pharmaceuticals, food, and so on. But this has all been very difficult, and they know that big European companies, when forced to choose between dealing with the United States and dealing with Iran, are going to deal with the United States. So their effort to keep Iran in the deal, and they believe Iran wants to stay in the deal and that Iran will wait to see if Trump is reelected, gets harder and harder. And as Robin Wright said, it doesn't really help when the Iranians set artificial deadlines. It puts Europe in a very difficult place. So it's complicated, and, you know, they are caught between the two.
Negar Mordasavi, how do these deadlines look to people in Iran, and how badly suffering are they as a result of the economic sanctions?
Well, the sanctions have really helped devastate the economy, and the way the Iranians see this is President Trump pulled out of the deal a year ago. He reimposed these sanctions. The economy is already worsening, and Iranians basically have been waiting for Europeans for a year to compensate for the reimposition of U.S. sanctions or the lack of U.S. presence in the deal economically. Europeans have come out very strongly. They have issued strong political statements, and they have basically rallied behind the deal as governments. But European companies operate separately from the European government. And what the Iranians are saying is that basically the Iranian deputy foreign minister, he called it statement therapy, that these political statements at the end of the day are not going to compensate for the economic benefit and the type of what Iranians are expecting and wanting to see. So I think what happened with President Rouhani and the moderates is they have been frustrated. They've been put in a very difficult position. They need it to seem like they're taking action to try to force the Europeans to stand up more to Europeans and actually deliver economically and in reality. But at the same time, it seems to backfire, to have backfired from the European side, and it might not actually be helpful in the process of the economic steps that Europeans would be taking.
Robin Wright, you mentioned the Saudi Arabia, you mentioned the UAE. To what extent is the United States taking sides with them in their struggle against Iran, and what's at stake?
One of the most striking aspects of President Trump's foreign policy since the beginning has been his strong alliance with Saudi Arabia, very much in contrast with President Obama, who was openly critical of Saudi domestic policy and foreign policy, and said so publicly. President Trump made his very first trip as president to Saudi Arabia and has remained close to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman despite the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi agents believed to be loyal to the Crown Prince. So there's no question that under Trump, the United States is taking sides and has provided weaponry, political leverage, and public endorsements to the kingdom.
Stephen Erlanger, does that create more pressure, more difficulty for the countries of Europe?
Well, they don't entirely disagree with the Trump anger about Iranian activity in the region. After all, Iran does back Hezbollah. Iran backs Hamas. Iran backs Islamic Jihad in Gaza. Iran says it wants to destroy Israel. So on these issues, the Europeans basically agree with Trump. They just disagree with what to do about it. And also, Iranians have tried to assassinate some Iranian critics in Europe, which has also angered the Europeans. So it's not, you know, that the Americans have switched full-heartedly to the Sunnis that bothers the Europeans so much. It's more Trump's kind of complete beholden quality to Israel and to Bibi Netanyahu's kind of effort to, as he says, sometimes annex the West Bank, who has no interest in any kind of peace settlement with the Palestinians. This troubles the Europeans, who still believe that a two-state solution is the only one that's possible. But, you know, again, quite ambivalent, because they believe Israel has a right to exist, and they're very troubled by some of these same things: Iran's missile program, Iran's support for terrorism, Iran's activities against Iranian dissidents inside Europe. I mean, they don't think Iran's a great actor. They just say Iran has done this nuclear deal we're signatories. They've kept to the deal. We should keep to the deal. And the deal was about nuclear issues only. It was not about all these other things, which we should continue to talk to Iran about. And they've tried to do that, but they've gotten very little help from Washington, I have to say.
Robin Wright, when you talk to Mr. Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, how concerned is he about what's going on between Israel and the Palestinians?
I don't think that's a front burner issue at the moment for the Iranians. And one of the ironies has always been that the average Iranian does not feel deeply attached to the Palestinian issue like the Arabs do. And they take a position ideologically. And of course, because Israel is so close to the United States, that's another reason for its position. But I don't think the Palestinian issue weighs heavily right now in the deliberations.
Nagar Mordasavi, do you think that Iranians generally care much about what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians?
Not very much. Definitely not as much as the government wants to portray it. Now, among the more political elite, there's definitely a sympathy for the cause of the Palestinians, for the injustice that's happening. But the amount of energy, the amount of resources, and basically the cost that the Iranian government has put behind the cause of the Palestinians is just not acceptable by the Iranian public, specifically because it has had very severe costs as far as the standoff with the U.S. and Israel, and the Iranian population is the one who's paying for these costs, for these very hard stances of the Iranian government, sometimes even stronger than the Palestinians themselves, is what the Iranians are saying. There's a saying in Persian that says the soup should never be hotter than the bowl should never be hotter than the actual soup, and that's the general sense you would get from an average Iranian on the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Nagar Mordasavi with The Independent, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, back to you. Anything you'd like to say? I know you need to leave us as well.
No, I just think it's a really interesting issue right now. The question is, does it go the way of North Korea, that when there is not some kind of movement, that the president suddenly diverts attention to something else, be it Venezuela, Russia? There are key summits coming up, much of it in Steve's territory. So I turn over to him, but I think that there's kind of an impasse now. What happens next? And the danger is we've got this build up. It will continue to be there. Is everyone really, really careful to make sure that something doesn't happen? Or do you see the kind of the history of U.S.-Iran relations over the past 40 years has been that it's been gyrating between confrontation and diplomatic overtures. And now we're kind of in that accelerated pace where you see the president offering to talk to the Iranians and at the same time deploying major military force in a way to counter anything that Iran might do. These are dangerous times either way.
Robin Wright again with the New Yorker magazine, author of Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It's always great to have you on our podcast.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Warren.
Stephen Erlanger with the New York Times, now been turned over to you by Robin Wright and by me. I'm following her lead in this regard. How are the Europeans at this point threading their way through all of this? Are there, with all the differences we now see growing between various European countries, unified in terms of their foreign policy?
Well, they're certainly unified in supporting the Iran deal, and they're unified in being very anxious that the Trump administration will provoke conflict with Iran, and that the Trump administration, though it says it wants to negotiate, is really interested in regime change. That's Europe's anxiety. It's very confused. Everyone's very confused. I think Robin talked about this, about who's actually deciding anything inside the White House, because Bolton's history and his comments have been very, very strong. The president is joked about how if he let Bolton have his head, we'd be in four wars all at once. Trump clearly campaigned on not getting involved with another war inside the Middle East. And if there was a war, I think Israel would be at risk. And he's, you know, a great supporter of Israel. And Pompeo, it's kind of unclear because Pompeo, you know, talks to the Europeans. I mean, they're allies. They are trying to figure out ways to sanction Iran on other issues. But, you know, they don't actually care that much what the Europeans really think. It's not like Iraq. You know, during the last Iraq war, Europe was divided in half, right? You had Britain and Poland really fighting on the side of the United States. And the leaders then of Britain and Poland, Tony Blair and Kwasniewski, were utterly screwed by their support for the United States. So everyone is very, very careful not to get on Trump's side because they really don't trust his judgment on what to do about Iran. So they're nervous. They're not sure what Washington really thinks. They're preaching restraint. They're preaching restraint to Tehran. They're trying to do more to help Tehran economically, but they are very, very anxious that it somehow there'll be an accident, that Tehran will be provoked. And this kind of little bits of provocation is something the Pentagon has predicted right along, and American intelligence predicted right along, that Iran would respond in some way to all this, what the Trump people called maximum pressure, that it had to respond. It had to respond for its own domestic reasons. And yet the worry is that these fairly calibrated so far responses will be used by the Trump people as provocations for a bigger conflict. So that's what really, really worries them. And they don't feel they have much agency, frankly, in these decisions. They don't think Washington listens to them very carefully. And I think they're right.
What did you mean when you said Israel might be at risk if there were a war?
Well, because if there's a real war in Iran, Hezbollah is going to fire rockets into Israel. I mean, Hezbollah is a very, very important proxy for Iran, and most of its weapons come from Iran and come from Syria, which Iran backs. And compared to the 2006 Lebanon-Israel war, this would be much, much worse because Hezbollah has many, many, many more missiles, and they're better quality missiles, and they could probably hit the entire country of Israel. So if the Americans attack for some reason Tehran, my assumption is, I think everyone's assumption is, Tehran would attack Israel with them rockets. And then, you know, it would try to widen the war. That would be everybody's anxiety.
Why would Iran attack Israel? What would be the purpose of that?
It would be to make it very clear to the Americans that there's a lot at stake there, that the issue is not just, you know, I mean, Iran can't attack Washington, but it can attack Washington's allies. And it could also use its proxies to attack American-backed governments in Iraq and it could use the Houthis, which are very dependent on Iran, to hit more at Saudi Arabia. My guess is that, you know, no one expects this war, but if it happened, my guess is it would become regional pretty quickly.
What about Saudi Arabia? And would Iran then strike out against Saudi Arabia if some sort of thing occurred? I know you and others have not predicted, that's not a term I think any of us wants to be associated with.
But exactly.
You have warned, and you have used these terms, that people think of the Iraq war as a catastrophe and of the any ensuing war that we might be talking about now as being even worse. So would that, for example, be likely to lead to confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Does Saudi Arabia have what it takes to respond?
Well, think about it from the other direction. If this is really hypothetical stuff.
Absolutely.
If the United States really went into Iran, right, and it would take quite a lot of troops, and it's more than a couple bombing missions. American ally Saudi Arabia might join in. It's quite possible. I mean, the Saudis really are very, very strong against Iran. And they believe Iran, which, you know, has tried to kill various Saudi officials, Iran backs the Houthis, and the Saudis are at war in Yemen in a fairly disgusting way, but they're at war in Yemen against the Iran-backed Houthis because Yemen's right next to Saudi Arabia. So the links are there, and, you know, one can see a fire that begins small getting larger. That's my concern. That's, I think, Europeans' concern, and I think it's Congress's concern, and I think it's Trump's concern, too. I don't think Trump wants this confrontation.
President Trump, of course, is very much involved in what's going on in Yemen. President Obama was before him. What's that doing to America's image in the places where you go?
Well, I mean, American support for the Saudis, really, it's a Saudi war. And, you know, Trump has very much been supportive of MBS, and it's been kind of considered MBS's war. Now, it's not been fought very well, and the Americans have been very worried about collateral damage and, you know, bombing civilians. And so they have, at different points, restricted arms supplies to the Saudis for use in Yemen. And Congress has talked about that too. So again, it's really a Saudi issue in Yemen, but since we're allies, since we supply arms to Saudi Arabia, we've tried to caution calm, but MBS doesn't really listen much to calm. And of course, it's been an issue for Europeans because Britain has been a big arms supplier to Saudi Arabia also. And there have been a lot of complaints inside the British government and houses of parliament about trying to restrict weapon supplies to Saudi Arabia because people are horrified at the war in this little place called Yemen, where, you know, there's cholera and hunger and people are dying.
Back to Iran, as we heard earlier from Robin Wright, President Trump declared the Revolutionary Guard to be a terrorist organization. She said nothing like that had ever happened in international diplomacy before. If John Bolton is seen as a provocateur of some kind, are the Revolutionary Guards also a provocateur?
I actually was in Tehran for the Iranian Revolution. I mean, I was there as a young reporter. I was there when hostages were taken. I visited while hostages were being taken. So, you know, I have a real interest in the place, which has never really died. But the revolution, which was an ideological revolution, I mean, Iran tried to spread the Islamic revolution all over the region. And it does, in some ways, have enormous cultural influence. The reason people start wearing hijab, you know, headscarves all over the Arab world has as much to do with the Islamic revolution as anything else. I mean, Palestinians never wore hijab before the Iranian revolution. So it's had a big impact, but the ICRG has been the kind of tool that the regime has used to spread revolution and to create regional allies. So the ICRG has been very, very important in Iraq and in Syria and in training Hezbollah and in Lebanon and in supplying Hamas with weaponry and rockets. I mean, they are, in a sense, almost separate from the government of Iran. I mean, they go directly through command to Khamenei, to the supreme leader. I don't think Rouhani has much influence over them at all. So it's always very difficult when we talk about Iran because, you know, a good friend of mine who was a French diplomat who helped negotiate the Iran deal used to joke that the only thing more complicated than the American interdepartmental process was the Iranian intermullah process because it's complicated and there's a lot of personalities involved. I mean, it's not a Western regime. It's a religiously dominated regime which has an ideology which it wants to spread. I mean, it's not doing very well. It hasn't done very well in spreading it, but it's done very well in supporting Shia all over the region, whether, you know, this is in Bahrain or in Syria or in southern Lebanon, and it has a big influence. I mean, Iran is a regional power. That's what's driving Trump, and it is a rival to the Sunnis, it's a rival to the Egyptians, it's a rival to the Saudis for power in the region, which is why it's so interesting that the Trump people have turned their back on the Shia and the Iran deal in favor of the Sunnis who feel that Iran is challenging them. I'm sure Robin talked about this, but this is the really important context of this new provocation on both sides. Iran was going along in a way, it didn't really matter. It was keeping to the deal, but Trump always called it the worst deal in history. The Republicans always, you know, refused even under Obama to ratify it. So it was never a treaty, it was just a deal. So it was easy for Trump to pull out of it. He's done so pretty much to support the Sunni argument that, you know, they need to challenge Iran's effort at dominating the Middle East.
Back to the effort to try to unravel the complexities of one administration or another. Let's look again at Washington. And we have John Bolton on the one hand, who, of course, has a very long and deep experience. He was ambassador to the UN at one point. Now we have the Secretary of State, Pompeo, who it seems to me is not as experienced as Bolton is. Was he sort of isolated in Brussels recently?
Well, he came, you know, he was going to waste a day in Moscow, Pompeo, before he went to Sochi to meet with Putin and Lavrov. So in a way, he had kind of a free day. And because American intelligence saw this enhanced threat from Iran, Pompeo decided to come to Brussels and brief allies. Now, he must have known, but in fact, European foreign ministers were all gathered for their own European foreign ministers meeting, which had its own quite tight agenda. So they were trying to cope with Pompeo's sudden desire to visit. And they decided that they didn't want to be kind of seen lining up behind him. So he met separately with the foreign ministers of the signatories to the Iran deal, which is Britain, France, and Germany, plus Federica Mogherini, who's the EU foreign policy chief, and then, you know, briefed them, didn't say all that much, but just told them what was going on, and then did no public events in Brussels at all. So there was, you know, no Pompeo statements. What we got was his aide, Brian Hook, who deals with Iran, you know, giving you sort of a readout of what these conversations were. So the Europeans didn't so much turn their back on him. They just, I mean, they listened, but, you know, they obviously are more worried about what's going to happen. They certainly didn't come out and say, God, you know, Pompeo's right. Iran's getting really dangerous right now. At the same time, they were polite, and I think they appreciated the fact that he would come talk to them. I mean, this is what allies do.
With regard to the EU, Iran has said, and not just the EU, but also China and Russia, Iran has said, if you guys don't do something about these sanctions, we're going to start looking at nuclear materials in laboratories again and all of that sort of thing. Is that going to be something that the EU can easily deal with, or is it one of those unknowns at this point that we simply can't even speculate about?
Well, it's very difficult for them to deal with it. I mean, they resent the sense of deadline. I understand that Rouhani has his problems. He has his domestic problems. They understand that the American sanctions are making life really hard in Iran, that the Americans, you know, ended oil sales waivers. So, you know, they're trying to reduce Iranian oil sales, on which two-thirds of the economy depends, to nothing. So it's getting tough for them. But as we were saying, the Europeans have a very hard time, you know, compensating in the same way for these sanctions, because, you know, European companies will not deal with Iran if it's going to block them from dealing with America, and if it's going to block them from the American banking system, and if it's going to block them from using the SWIFT banking system or using the dollar. So, you know, the Europeans can want this to happen, but, you know, they can't order their companies to deal with Iran when they don't want to do it.
What about Russia and China?
Well, this is the thing. China has, you know, and Russia have both said that they don't believe the new American threats. They're very worried about them. They are very angry that Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, as China is the largest purchaser of Iranian oil. I think it will continue to purchase Iranian oil. It's a little bit less dependent on the American banking system than other countries are. And, you know, the Russian trade with Iran will probably go on, but it won't make up for the American loss because of sanctions. It just won't. It can't.
Okay, an awful lot going on. We've managed to cover quite a lot today on this program. Never enough. Stephen Erlanger, always good to talk with you, Chief European Diplomatic Correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
All the best.
This To The Point podcast was produced by Andrea Brody, with production assistance from John Reed. Our engineer is Chuck Prebatary. I'm Warren Olney. Make sure to check out this week's Climate Change Update, an interview with Washington Governor Jay Inslee, the candidate who says the only thing that matters is climate change because it involves everything else. Hit us up on social media. On Twitter, it's tothepoint_KCRW. You can reach me at warren.olney@kcrw.org. Thanks for listening.